Welcome to the Middle Chamber Books and Music Podcast. I'm your podcast host, Steve Lubetkin. Podcast Steve on Twitter. I'm the proprietor of our Amazon-affiliated bookstore, middlechamberbooks.com. We are part of the Amazon family, and we appreciate your support of our efforts to sell a few books. And one of the ways we do that is by interviewing authors of books and artists who create the music that we sell in the bookstore. Within days of the bombing of Pearl Harbor, the Japanese began an invasion of the Philippine Islands. 4 months later, with food and ammunition supplies running out, the American army surrendered to the Japanese. Forced to march more than 50 miles up the Bataan Peninsula, tens of thousands of soldiers, both American and Filipino, were subjected to unremitting brutality by their captors. Harry J. Whittinghill was a survivor of the Bataan Death March. He enlisted in April 1941 and arrived in the Philippines in November of that year. Following the grueling march and his harrowing transport on what he described as a Japanese hell ship, he spent more than 3 years as a prisoner of war in a forced labor camp. Whittinghill, who died in 1987, detailed the horrors he lived through while often commenting on the odds of his own survival. His memoir, discovered during a chance conversation with his grandsons, describes how luck and willpower kept him alive. The book, When Men Have to Die, is out in paperback. It's compiled by Dr. John McLaughlin, a history professor at Drew University, who is also the author of General Albert C. Wiedemeyer, America's Unsung Strategist in World War II. And Paul Zygo, a retired history professor from Brookdale Community College and military historian, who's also the founder and director of the World War II Era Studies Institute. And their third co-author is Marie Summers, a graduate of Newton College of the Sacred Heart and a retired director of communication for information technology at Seton Hall University. Now, Paul Zygo and I have a bit of a history. We first met when I was a student broadcaster at Monmouth University. It was then Monmouth College. And as the production director for the college radio station, I was the engineer who recorded a show, Speaking of Monmouth, that Paul hosted while he was the director of community affairs at Monmouth College back in the 1970s. We later reconnected when Paul was teaching history at Brookdale Community College. Paul is a retired Army colonel. He's written several books about World War II, and we reconnected at Brookdale when he was running the Center for World War II Studies at the Community College in Lincroft in Monmouth County, Central New Jersey. And we've done some podcasts and videos from some of the World War II lectures that Paul organized while he was there. So it was a real pleasure to reconnect with him once again and talk to him about his latest book. We spoke by phone from his home in Monmouth County. Paul, thanks for joining us on the Middle Chamber Books and Music Podcast.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
It's great to reconnect with you. We've got a long history together, including the time we spent co-producing your radio show at Monmouth University back in the, well, in the dark ages when we used magnetic recording tape.
So you remember all that?
I vaguely remember magnetic tape and razor blades and grease pencils, but now here we are in a digital world doing podcasts, and you have a new book out, When Men Have to Die. It's a memoir of the Bataan Death March. What made you decide this was a good time to focus on this terrible piece of World War II history?
Steve, what we're going to be celebrating or commemorating in the upcoming months will be this crucial battle that took place in the Philippines in 1942. And at the end of this major battle, which the United States Armed Forces, together with the Filipino Armed Forces, together lose, the result happens to be the capture of nearly 80,000 troops on the peninsula of Bataan. And 75 years ago, upon the defeat of the American Filipino Army, what comes about is what's known as the Bataan Death March. And during the course of that death march, some 10,000 men were either killed or seriously mostly wounded, and the end result is one of the world's worst wartime atrocities comes about. This is what we're going to be commemorating come these upcoming months. The Bataan Death March took place specifically during the month of April, 1942.
So how did you come to this particular story? There were so many men on the Death March, so many stories. What made Harry Whittinghill's story stand out?
Harry Whittinghill's family came to Brookdale Community College when I was working there and was the director of the Center for World War II Studies and Conflict Resolution. And what they did was leave with the center Whittinghill's wartime memoirs. And the memoirs contain pictures that he drew when he was a prisoner of war with the Japanese over a 3.5-year period of time. And what they wanted to do was just simply leave the documents and the pictures with the center. And what I encouraged them to do was to, one, all right, we'll accept these documents, but also submit the documents to the National Archives, Library of Congress, because these are very historic documents that they had in hand. Well, what this led to is an affiliation with the director of the New Jersey World War II Book Club, and his name, Dr. John McLaughlin, and also Marie Summers, who is the former director of information for the Information Technology Department at Seton Hall University. It led to us looking at these documents and coming up with the idea of, in advance of the commemoration of the Fall of Bataan, putting together this book entitled When Men Had to Die, and incorporate within the book Harry Whittinghill's memoirs as well as his pictures.
So you've actually combined in the book not only the stories, the recollections of Harry Whittinghill, but also some essays to provide context about what he's talking about.
Yes, there's an opening chapter which John McLaughlin in particular wrote, and it details what took place during the critical period of time of December 1941 through April 1942, which led to the fall of the Bataan Peninsula. John details that. What I do afterwards in the closing chapters is detail the impact of the fall of Bataan on American history, and also what happened to the veterans of the various POW camps that Japan had maintained, and what type of attention they received from the United States government upon their return to the U.S. And, Steve, in essence, it was minimal attention when it should have been otherwise. In no way, shape, or form were the veterans of the World War II POW camps treated as, well, we now treat the veterans returning from Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan. They were ignored, and as a consequence, they suffered through the rest of their lives with either disabilities or with illnesses that in no way, shape, or form were they aided in overcoming by the U.S. government.
Well, that's interesting. Most people, I think, have a conception that the POWs came home to, you know, essentially gratitude, heroes, welcome, that sort of thing, but that's not the case.
That's not the case. That is not the case. In fact, what also perpetuates this ignoring of the return of World War II veterans is the fact that when the veterans came home, all they wanted to do was get back to the way of life they had been experiencing prior to going to war. And, Steve, what this leads to is very, very few of the veterans willing to talk to anybody what they experience. So sons and daughters of these veterans never really did know what their dads, in some case mothers, experienced during the course of World War II. But what changes all that is the film that comes out in 1990, which is Saving Private Ryan. And when that film came out, and the sons and daughters of World War II veterans saw the opening segment of that film pertaining to the invasion of Omaha Beach in Normandy, France. It caused many, many of them to come home and say, "Dad, is this what you experienced? Is this what happened to you?" And this is what opens up this conversation between sons and daughters and their fathers, and in some case, mothers.
Mm. It was a powerful scene. It was, for many people of my generation, probably as close as we could get to imagining what it might have been like.
Steve, that's the case. That's the case. Now, one thing about the Witting Hill memoir, although we had this agreement with the family to somehow, some way incorporate within a publication, what really propelled us to do so was the sons of Harry Witting Hill. He passed away in 1987. When the sons of Harry Witting Hill just recently approached John McLaughlin and asked if he would definitely move forward on the effort of putting together this book. And we did. And it was published at the end of January of this year. First editions were made available at the beginning of February of this year, meaning this month. And unfortunately, and I truly mean this in a very, very sad way, unfortunately, just before the announcement that the book was available for publication, John McLaughlin passed away.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Very, very sad. John never did realize the benefit of his effort in terms of putting together this book and actually seeing the book available to the public.
Paul, when you went through Harry Witting Hill's memoir, did you find any... did he have any explanation, any thoughts as to how he was able to survive this ordeal when so many others didn't?
Well, the interesting comment that has stuck with me ever since reading the memoir is a comment that was rendered Harry Witting Hill by his father, who survived, of all things, Andersonville Prison during the Civil War. Andersonville Prison was maintained down in Georgia by the Confederate Army. And prisoners of war there were brutally treated by the Confederates. His father survived that brutality. And he passed on to Harry that if indeed you ever come face to face with situations of this nature, Harry, you do not have anyone to rely upon but yourself. Do not think that your friends can be of assistance to you in aiding you to survive. You only have yourself. And he relates that in the memoir. And he feels, because of that guidance, he survives 3.5 years of imprisonment.
Well, that's got to make you feel very isolated, though, that you can't rely on your friends or anybody else.
Yes. That's the reason why that stuck with me, and still does. It still does.
Is this anything that the military, and you've had a long career in the military, both on active duty and as a reserve officer,
yes,
and retired as a colonel, does the military do any kind of training to help prepare soldiers and sailors for these kinds of possibilities?
Steve, that's an interesting question, because as I'm thinking about it right now, no, I've never, regardless of what station I was at, regardless of what rank, regardless of what schooling, did I ever encounter any instruction or any lesson pertaining to, if indeed you are captured, what life may be like and what you have to do to survive. No, Steve, not one lesson, not one training program pertained to that subject.
Interesting. Now, Paul, you've recently, in the past couple of years, retired from teaching at Brookdale Community College, where we reconnected. You founded something called the World War II Era Studies Institute. Talk a little bit about that and what its role is and how people can get in touch with it.
Steve, once retiring what I decided to do with the cooperation of my wife is continue the effort to educate as best I could those within the community about the World War II era, and most importantly, its impact. Because, Steve, the impact of the World War II era is the world we live in today. And since establishing the Institute and making programs available throughout the state and also beyond, the Institute has scheduled this past year, throughout 2016, some 26 programs, and all pertaining to the history of World War II and its impact. But, Steve, what amazes me beyond belief is the enthusiasm people have in learning about this era. And what I urge them all to do is please take this enthusiasm for this period of time. Take what you've learned about this period of time, be it this one presentation or another, and pass it on. Pass it on to your sons, to your daughters, to children within your community, to those within the various school systems. Because, Steve, right now, within high school systems throughout the state, one thing that is not really being taught is American history. In times past, American history was a requirement within a high school curriculum. Steve, it no longer is. What American history now is an elective. Students do not have to take courses in American history.
Even in the high schools?
Even in high schools.
Wow.
Part of the curriculum, it is part of the curriculum, but not mandatory. It's an elective.
It's pretty amazing.
It's the reason why I urge all my audiences to please carry on pass on your enthusiasm for this period of time, pass on your knowledge of this period of time to your sons, your daughters, and the up-and-comers within your community. They need to know. They need to know.
As you look at the World War II era, as you've been doing for many decades, Paul, what do you think are the enduring lessons that people should be taking away from that World War II experience?
One thing that, in particular, I would definitely stress is the fact that in the face of a threat, that those within the United States came together under our national leadership and committed themselves to countering that threat and then ultimately defeating it. Now, the reason I mention that is because, in essence, it's the first time that this nation came together as a nation to eliminate what would have been a disaster if indeed the fascist states within the world of the 1930s and 1940s succeeded in taking over the world. In essence, they were out to establish new world orders. And Steve, if they did, we would not be living the life we are living today. We just would not. And by the way, the one thing that I'd like to see, but I don't at the moment sense, is a national leadership providing leadership pertaining to a new world threat. That new world threat, as far as I'm concerned, based upon my reading, is the radical fundamental Islamic movement. Radical fundamentalism. It's another ism, Steve. And in essence, this ism is set out to establish a new world order in a certain sector of the world, meaning the Middle East, and via that new world order, implement a new way of life. And in essence, I compare the rise of that ism to the rise of an ism that arose in Germany throughout the 30s and was carried forth throughout the 1940s. That ism being Nazism.
Well, it's a scary world, and there's certainly some threats out there, and we can learn from the vigilance that won us World War II. Paul, thanks for being with us on the podcast.
Steve. My pleasure. Thank you for having me on board.
Paul Zygo is a retired professor of history and a military historian. He's the co-author with Dr. John McLaughlin and Marie Summers of the new memoir, When Men Have to Die, Harry J. Whittinghill's memoir of the Bataan Death March. If you have any comments or suggestions about the program, you can write to me. It's steve@middlechamberbooks.com. We produce these programs in the studios of Professional Podcasts. It's one of our Lubetkin Media companies here in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. We're on the web at beingthemedia.com. Our PodSafe music comes to us from the Indianapolis Jazz Orchestra. It's called Cook the Books. For everyone here at the Middle Chamber Books and Music Podcast, this is Steve Lubetkin. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you out there on the net. Take good care.